The next subheading is Arnold's Theory of Poetry, The Definition and Function of Poetry, The Grand Style, Arnold's Classicism, Touchstone Method. His classicism. Arnold's classicism, his love of Hellenic culture, art and literature, is reflected everywhere in his critical writings. It is reflected even in the early preface to the poems 1853, which is a kind of manifesto of his critical creed. What he says in the preface, he kept saying throughout his career. It reflects not only his classicism, but also his views on the grand style and his theory of poetry, which was later on elaborated in the study of poetry. The other subheading, stress on action. He begins the preface by pointing out the reasons why he had not included his poem Empedocles on Athena in the new collection. He had rejected the poem, though earlier he had esteemed it highly, because in it there was very little action. The hero suffered. He brooded and brooded over his suffering and finally committed suicide. His suffering did not issue out in action, and therefore it was not a fit subject for poetry. Mere subjectivity, the inner gloom or melancholy of the poet, morbid preoccupation with thought to the neglect of action, can never result in great poetry. Poetry of highest order requires a suitable action, an action sufficiently serious and weighty. Poetry, all art, is dedicated to joy, and this joy results from the magnificence of its action. Even high tragedy gives joy, for in it magnificently suffering issues out in magnificent action. This stress on action reminds one of Aristotle's stress on fable or action, which he regarded the prime thing, the soul of tragedy. Action is everything. All depends upon the choice of a right subject. Arnold is a classicist in his insistence on the importance of action as the proper theme of poetry. The next subheading is Subject for Poetry. But what are the subjects proper for poetry, subjects which can impart the highest pleasure? Arnold's classicism is again seen when he points out that it is wrong to suppose that modern poets should choose modern subjects. Modern subjects will not do, for in the modern age there was too much of Philistinism or vulgarization of values as a result of the advance of science and technological advancement. His plea is for the choice of ancient subjects, subjects such as were the choice of Homer and other Greek masters. The character of the subject chosen is all important. He writes, "The business of the poet is not to praise their age, but to afford to them who live in it the highest pleasure which they are capable of feeling." If asked to afford this by means of subjects drawn from the age itself, they ask what special fitness the present age has for supplying them. They are told that it is an era of progress, as an commissioned to carry out the great ideas of industrial development and social amelioration. They reply that with all this they can do nothing, that the elements they need for the exercise of their art are great actions calculated powerfully and delightfully to affect what is permanent in the human soul. Passing actions possesses so much that it is of passing value that the Greeks wisely left them to be treated by the comic poet. Poets should choose actions that please always and please all. Actions that are of this nature, that most powerfully appeal to those elementary feelings which are independent of time, are the fittest subjects for poetry. It is immaterial whether they are ancient or modern, so long as they satisfy this test of abiding appeal. But an age wanting in moral grandeur, says Arnold with reference to his own age, can with difficulty supply such. Therefore, the poets must go to the ancients for themes. Then the other subheading is manner and style. Further, Arnold is a classic in his views on the manner and style of poetry. It is wrong to suppose that the inferiority of subject can be covered by superior treatment. No amount of embellishment and decoration, no excellence of simile and metaphor can for long hide the inferiority of substance. No unworthy subject can be made delightful by an excellent treatment. Highest poetry and highest poetic pleasure result from the whole and not from separate parts, from the harmony of matter and manner and not from manner alone. He writes, "This the Greeks understood far more clearly than we do. With them, the poetical character of the action in itself was the first consideration. With us, attention is fixed mainly on the value of the separate thoughts and images which occur in the treatment of an action. They regarded the whole, we regard the parts. With them, the action predominated over the expression of it. With us, the expression predominates over the action. Not that they failed in expression or were inattentive to it. On the contrary, they are the highest models of expression, the unapproached masters of the grand style. But their expression is so excellent because it is so admirably kept in its right degree of prominence, because it is so simple and so well subordinated, because it draws its force directly from the pregnancy of the matter which it conveys. Expression, therefore, cannot take the place of action, which is the first condition of poetry. Expression is itself dependent for its effectiveness on the excellence of the action. Where the latter is wanting, the former has no legs to stand on. The subject or action should be excellent and the treatment of it should be severe and simple, as it is in the ancient classics. Even when it is grand, the grandeur should be severely restrained. Writes Saintsbury, that all depends on the subject, had been said often enough before, but it had not been said by anyone who had the whole of literature before him and a tendency for half a century distinctly, for a full century more or less, had been to unsay or gainsay it. Further, the critic has combined with the older neoclassic adoration of the fable something perhaps traceable, as hinted above, to the Wordsworthian horror of poetic diction, a sort of cult of baldness instead of beauty, and a distrust, if not horror, of expression. In fact, though I do not believe that he is in the least new it, he is taking up a position of direct and, as it were, designed antagonism to Dryden's in that remarkable preference to An Evening's Love, where he says plainly, "The story is the least part, and declares that the important part is workmanship. The next subheading of this chapter is the ancients as safe models. Next, he considers the problem of a suitable guide or model and again concludes that it is only the ancients who can be safely followed. Shakespeare is not a safe guide, for though he has excellence of subject, he is unable to say a thing plainly even when the press of the action demands the very directest language. And what is worse, by its very force it catches the attention more than his fundamental excellences as a poet. Arnold, therefore, does not consider him a safe model. To undo this mischief, there was no other way than to turn to ancients, to admirable treatise of Aristotle and the unrivaled works of their poets. From them, the modern poet will learn how unspeakably superior is the effect of one moral impression left by a great action treated as a whole, to the effect produced by the most striking single thought or by the happiest image. He will cultivate, too, a respect for the wholesome regulative laws of poetry, which were threatened in the modern age by their eternal enemy, caprice. The next subheading is the grand style. Further, Arnold's classicism is seen in his views on the grand style, of which he says the ancients were the unapproached masters. Though the phrase occurs in the preface of 1853, it is in his essay on translating Homer that his views on the subject are fully developed. Homer, he says, was the grand master of the grand style. The grand style ennobles poetry and it ennobles life. It arises in poetry when a noble nature, poetically gifted, treats with simplicity or severity a serious subject. The definition is vague, but it becomes clear if we remember that Arnold's grand style is the same as the sublime of Longinus. For the grand style, there must be first nobility of soul, for great words issues only from great minds. B. Subject or action chosen must be serious enough. It must have truth of substance and high seriousness. Then C. The treatment must be severe or simple. It must be simple like the style of Homer or severe like that of Milton. Even when gorgeous, its gorgeousness must be severely restrained. And D. It goes without saying, and Arnold feels no need of saying it, that the stylist must be poetically gifted. Homer, Dante, and Milton were masters of it, but other English poets are lacking in this quality. Modern poets like Keats do not have the shaping power, the architecture which great poetry should have. They have short passages and single line of admitted excellence, but not the beauty of the whole. But it is the total impression which counts and which is conducive to the grand style. Therefore, we must take the ancient classics as our models for our matter and manner. Thus, in Arnold's view, only a poetry modeled on the ancients can serve as an antidote to contemporary Philistinism, Americanism. Indeed, Arnold's theory of poetry is to be understood as a counterblast of romantic individualism, subjectivity, and contempt for authority. Wimstedt and Brooks visualize Arnold as the most imposing figure in English mid-Victorian criticism, not as part of lyric spasmodic movement, but in a brusque classical resistance to it. He provides a countercheck quarrelsome to the prevailing lyrical trend, a reaffirmation of the classical norm of the fable. Then the next subheading is Exalted Conception of Poetry, Its Uses and Definition. These very views are repeated, elaborated, or stated with greater emphasis in his study of poetry, which first appeared as an introduction to A.C. Ward's Selections from English Poets. Arnold has a high conception of his own calling. He is confident that good poetry has an immense future. It is in poetry where it is worthy of its high destinies. It is in poetry where it is worthy of its high destinies. Our race, as time goes on, will find an ever surer and surer stay. It is capable of higher uses, interpreting life for us, consoling us, and sustaining us. That is, it will replace what we understand by religion and philosophy, dependent on reasonings, which are but false sources of knowledge. Poetry with such a high destiny must be of highest standard. He quotes Saint Beuve's words, "In the order of thought, in art, the glory, the eternal honor is that charlatanism shall find no entrance." CHARLATANISM. Arnold declares formally, in poetry as a criticism of life under the conditions fixed for such a criticism by the laws of poetic truth and poetic beauty, the spirit of our race will find, as time goes on, and so other helps fail, its consolation and stay. But the consolation and stay will be of power in proportion to the power of the criticism of life. And the criticism of life will be of power in proportion as the poetry conveying it is excellent rather than inferior, sound rather than unsound or half sound, true rather than untrue or half true. The extract expresses Arnold's faith in the power of poetry and its high destiny, as well as his famous definition of poetry. In the rest of essay, Arnold elaborates his definition and then illustrates it by applying it to a number of English poets. Poetry as criticism of life. It is in poetry, which is a criticism of life, that the spirit of our race will find its last source of consolation and stay. Arnold himself explains criticism of life as the noble and profound application of ideas to life, and laws of poetic truth and poetic beauty as truth and seriousness of substance and matter, and felicity and perfection of diction and manner. Arnold believes that poetry does not present life as it is, rather the poet adds something to it from his own noble nature, and this something contributes to his criticism of life. Poetry makes men moral, better, and nobler, but it does so not through direct teaching or by appealing to reason like science, but by appeal into the soul, to the whole of man. The poet gives in his poetry what he really and seriously believes in. He speaks from the depth of his soul. He speaks it so beautifully that he creates a thing of beauty and so a perennial source of joy. Such high poetry makes life richer and has the power of sustaining and delighting us as nothing else can. It answers the question, how to live? But it does so indirectly by conforming to the ideals of truth and goodness, and thus by uplifting and ennobling the soul. Arnold is against direct moral teaching. He regards didactic poetry as the lowest. The next subheading is Standards and Methods of Judgment. Next, the question arises how to recognize the features of high poetry. Arnold does not lay down any such specific features, for he says they can better be recognized in the words of the master than in the prose of the critic. It is much better to study concrete examples of highest poetry and to say that his poetry has the features which we find here. We will recognize high poetry from the fact that it has something of perennial interest, something which appeals to the primary human affections and instinct. He writes in this connection, it is much better simply to have recourse to concrete examples, to take specimens of poetry of high, the very highest quality, and to say, the characters of a high quality of poetry are what is expressed there. He bids us shun the false valuations of the historic estimate and the personal estimate and attain to a real estimate by learning to feel and enjoy the vast work of the real classic and appreciate the wide difference between it and all lesser work. If we ask now, we are to know this best when we see it. He answers that it is enough, in general, to acclaim it. It is there and there. But if that is not enough, he adds that the high qualities lie both in the matter and substance of poetry and its manner and style, and these have a mark and accent of high beauty, worth and power. The substance and matter will possess in an eminent degree truth and seriousness, and this character is inseparable from the superiority of diction and movement. He marks the style and manner. Then the next subheading, the right method. As a further aid for distinguishing high poetry from one which is not high, he prescribes his well-known touchstone method. He says, there can be no more useful help for discovering what poetry belongs to the class of the truly excellent and can therefore do us most good than to have always in one's mind lines and expressions of great masters and to apply them a touchstone to other poetry. Of course, we are not to require this other poetry to resemble them. It may be very dissimilar, but if we have any tact, we shall find them. When we have lost them well in our minds, an infallible touchstone for detecting the presence or absence of high poetic quality and also the degree of this quality in all other poetry which we may place beside them. Then, taking a few widely different passages from Homer, Dante, Shakespeare, and Milton, he points out how they all impress equally by their poetical quality, so they all belong to the class of the truly excellent. This open appeal to the chunklet, as Wimstedt and Brooks observe. This sample piece of precious stuff is a rather startling shift towards the norm of style, run away from the initial classic thesis of 1853 that the action is all. This judgment by short passages or lines certainly goes contrary to his earlier thesis that it is the total impression which counts. Further, a passage taken out of its context often creates a false impression and may not be a sure sign of excellence. But as R.A. Scott James points out, there is no reason why we should not extend his comparative method, not resting content with detached judgments from isolated passages, but comparing the whole impression we have in our mind of one work with the whole impression that has been stamped upon our minds by a masterpiece. The comparative method is an invaluable aid to appreciation in approaching any kind of art. This is just as true of fiction as of poetry, of painting, of literature. And it is helpful not merely thus to compare the masterpiece and the lesser work, but the good with the not so good, and sincere with the not quite sincere, and cleverer with the not cleverer by half. Arnold has provided us with an excellent example of how to use the comparative method, and he has enabled us to see that it may be fruitful in the highest degree when employed by a critic of tact and understanding.